And now for Coast to Coast, we will be talking with Jim Eldridge about the universe solved and also EMPs. What happens if we get hit with one of those? So get ready on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back, and he's back. Jim Eldridge is with us, holding a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. He has applied his training in the high-tech world as a leader in technology and enterprise management, many years in executive roles for various companies as well, and some entrepreneurial ventures. He also holds 4 patents in digital signal processing, and for many years, he's kept pace with the latest research, theories, discoveries in the varied fields of subatomic physics, cosmology, artificial intelligence, nanotech, and also the paranormal. Jim, you've done it all. How are you? Welcome back.
Thank you very much, George. It's great to be back on the show.
Hey, I wanted to take a few moments and tap into your brain about EMPs. There's some talk again about incredible dangers in our technological era if we get hit either with a X flare or someone, you know, launches a nuke in the atmosphere high above us and creates this EMP. I mean, is this serious stuff right now, Jim?
Yeah, I really do think it is, George. It's certainly not something that can be underestimated in terms of the impact that it would have. I think the likelihood of something could be debated, you know, whether it's a solar flare or, you know, a terrorist bomb exploded in the upper atmosphere or something like that. But what happens is when a device were to go off or something generates gamma rays, which can come from a solar flare, these gamma rays knock electrons out of basically the gas that's in the upper atmosphere. And those electrons, because there are so many of them, they essentially constitute a large circuit, a large current in the upper atmosphere. And then what happens is the magnetic field of the Earth kind of gets involved with that, redirects them, and creates this pulse. And it's actually 3 pulses. The first pulse, called E1, is the worst one. It's kind of like the equivalent of like a sonic boom of electromagnetic energy. Although it's not directly dangerous to people, it would fry most integrated circuits that are in your computers, in electronics, in communication devices, cell towers, things like that. And that would be where the problem would start, because once that's out, you know, the question is how fast can we replace all of that stuff? I've read some reports where they say it would send us back into the early 1800s. I don't know if that's really, you know, that serious, but, it's certainly, if you can imagine, most people spend a lot of their time these days at work on the computer. They're doing reports, they're writing software, whatever, you know, the function is, we rely heavily on the internet, on the computer, on communication devices. And if those were out, it's just a matter of time before companies would say, you know what, don't bother coming in. We're not going to pay anybody until we can get everything back up again. And then people are losing income. Mm-hmm. When they lose income, then, you know, all kinds of things can happen. So it really could be a disaster if there were such, such an event that caused an EMP.
And the stores, you couldn't shop. I mean, the grocery stores now rely on computers and barcodes. I mean, I remember going shopping with my mother when I was a kid, Jim, and, you know, the cashier had to push everything in by hand, you know, one finger at a time. Well, they couldn't do that anymore.
Exactly. I mean, I was actually thinking about that today. How often have you seen somebody take cash for something, not scan your purchase, put it in a drawer and give you a handwritten receipt? It just doesn't happen much anymore.
It doesn't. I cited the example of a drugstore in St. Louis a year or so ago, had a power failure, so they tried to stay open and do things by hand. They stopped in about an hour. They couldn't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
yeah.
You know, the ATMs would go out. Everything would go.
Everything would go out. There are things that can be done. As I understand it, I remember from my old days in electronics that devices had different specifications associated with them, and there was one called mil-spec, which was a standard for how well it could withstand temperature and radiation and things like that. Military equipment uses mil-spec components, and they could, theoretically, they can withstand a lot of this. So, you know, in terms of a military response, if there was some sort of terrorist activity, you know, I think the military would be fairly sound. But the private sector would be devastated, and you know, what could we do to protect against that? There are some things, actually. I think that, I mean, first of all, don't let the device get into the upper atmosphere. So, you know, right. that's the first thing.
Now, what if it's launched from space?
Yeah, I mean, there would just have to be some sort of, you know, anti-missile system. You know, it's not certainly not my area of expertise, but, yeah. You know, those are the scary things. I think, you know, launching from space obviously is a much higher technology than, you know, a Scud missile kind of device launched from a barge or something.
Right.
So I would imagine that that's quite a few years off for most, you know, kind of terrorist countries who might, you know, have it out for us. But, you know, some of the other things that we can do is we could theoretically use some of the mil-spec parts for critical communication and kind of our financial infrastructure so that the backbone, you know, the electronic backbone and the computational backbone stays up. It wouldn't do much for the desktop computer that you have and a lot of the, you know, the equipment that companies buy, but, you know, maybe the internet could be salvaged. And the other thing is equipment that's put in a Faraday cage, which is basically a metal cage that absorbs, effectively shields the devices inside from anything. So you could even have non-mil-spec components inside a Faraday cage that would withstand some level of EMP, I think.
Well, let's hope we never get to this point, Jim, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
We'll see, because we don't have backups anymore. We used to have landline backups. I don't think we even have those, do we?
No, you know, it is kind of scary how reliant we are on things that, you know, as we kind of evolve technologically, you know, it seems like we get further and further from the, you know, the roots of building things and the, you know, the roots of replacing things. So, you know, it's harder to get back to basics as time goes on.
Well, that's true, too. Now, what's new with you, Jim, since you were last on with me last year?
Well, I've been writing a number of papers, George. Generally, I post those on my site. Graham Hancock has been kind enough to post those on his site, too. He's a good friend. And you're doing a lot of research in things. There's really been some interesting stuff that's come along, some new research. You've probably reported on some of it, maybe heard of some of these things, but some of them really fascinate me. One of them was back in 2009, there was the MAGIC telescope, which is a gamma ray imaging telescope for deep mm-hmm. space. It was determined that light that was traveling huge distances, like 500 million light years of distance, they lose energy depending on how much energy, you know, the light wave has. And that nature of the energy loss is actually consistent with the idea that space would be quantized. You can think of it as, you know, photons traveling 500 million light years through space, but bouncing off the infrastructure of space, or bouncing off the sort of the you know, the construct of space, over that much time and that much distance, they noticed a 4-minute anomaly, which means that the, you know, one's photons of a certain energy differed from photons of a different energy by a matter of 4 minutes, and that's a very small amount over such a great distance, but it correlated with the idea that space might be quantized. And, you know, these are the kind of things that interest me, because the book that I wrote is about, you know, whether or not we live in a programmed reality. Mm-hmm. You know, could our reality be quantized in some way? And things like this kind of lend some support to the idea. They don't prove it, but they do provide some evidence.
And tell me about that phrase, programmed reality. What is that?
Well, what that really means is, and that's not my phrase, Philip K. Dick, actually, a science fiction writer, I was the first one that I knew who ever used that, and he stated in 1977 that He felt we were living in a computer-programmed reality. So, you know, the ideas have been out there for a while, but basically the idea is that everything that we interact with, everything that we see, could be generated by some sort of computational mechanism. And it's, you know, it's kind of like the movie The Matrix is probably the easiest thing to understand the idea. But there are other ways that you could generate a programmed reality. You could actually generate a physical reality through program means via nanotech or technologies that are beyond that. And, you know, it's a little bit hard of a concept to accept at first. And, you know, I'm the first to admit that I'm not fully there either. My book really just presents all the evidence and really kind of, you know, leads to the conclusion that it's definitely possible and actually very probable. But when you think about the directions that we're going now in terms of video games, virtual reality, simulations, you know, brain-computer interfaces, mm-hmm. all these kind of things are possible within 20, 30 years. And in fact, you know, given the way we're going right now, probably sooner rather than later, that we'll be able to create a completely different reality, indistinguishable from what we think of as real reality. So, you know, then the question is, if we're going to be creating millions of those in 20, 30 years' time, how do we know we're not already living in one? And that's kind of what some of these ideas explore.
And there could be many of them, too.
There could be, absolutely.
You wrote in an article that the past can be changed. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's really kind of a fascinating idea, too. And some people have been doing some research on this. One of the specific examples, which just fascinates me a lot, is something called the quantum eraser experiment. I don't know if you've heard of that, but you're probably familiar with the double slit experiment in quantum mechanics, where you fire electrons basically a barrier that has two slits in it, and on the other side of that barrier is a screen that records the electrons coming through the slits. Well, it turns out that it makes an interference pattern, which people, you know, were baffled at when they first noticed that electrons, these things that they used to think of as like billiard ball type devices, actually formed an interference pattern. Well, they've taken this experiment to, you know, much greater depths and have now done things where if you can observe which slit the electron goes through, the interference pattern disappears. So in other words, all you have to do is put some sort of device in there that can determine what slit it goes through, and it changes the outcome of the experiment. And that's what's called the observer effect. And that's a lot of people have written about that idea where, you know, our observation of experiments is a key part of the results of those experiments. So that's, you know, that's all been done quite a bit, and physicists have kind of had to come to terms with the idea that people's observational attributes in terms of an experiment really play a role in the results of the experiment. But one of the things that's been done recently is where they put some delays in some of the paths of these particles, and they can then actually erase the information that that determined which slit it went through, so that effectively they are removing the interference pattern even after the photons hit the detector. So in other words, it's something they're influencing the past by an action that's being taken in the present.
Will that make time travel possible?
It could. I mean, that gives you, you know, an example that if you can influence the past, you know, time travel is a little bit different of a way to get into that. But, you know, these ideas, this is just a, you know, one specific example of influencing the past. Paul Davies had suggested that conscious observers can actually reach back in history to exert influence on early events in the universe, and that was his way of explaining how the universe fine-tunes itself. you know, there was a study back in the 80s by Helmut Schmidt that showed that people can influence past random number sequences. So they would experiment with these individuals who would try to guess random numbers, and the results would actually, you know, they showed a kind of retrocausality. They showed that the results changed in the past. Time travel to the past, scientifically, it's possible. I know you've had some physicists and astronomers on the show, Kip Thorne and other people, who have talked about how it's possible via these really exotic devices that have exotic matter or cosmic strings or something like that. But time travel into the past via programmed reality is a lot easier. I mean, it actually is very simple if you think about it. If you think about how a program works, let's say a gaming program or something that records a record of everything that happens in the game. Well, that record is the past. What's our past? Our past is really just the artifacts that make up the past, like newspaper reports or you know, television reports or something like that, and memories. So artifacts and memories.
And memories, yep.
The artifacts can be replaced. And if we're under a programmed reality, the program theoretically could very easily replace all artifacts related to some event, for example. And what about memories? Can memories be erased? Well, we're now erasing memories. We're selectively erasing memories in mice. So we've proven that we can actually do that. So, you know, to some sense, you know, one way of looking at it is that a programmed reality model of the universe allows you to travel back in time without having to worry about any of that grandfather paradox stuff, because you don't necessarily have to interact with things. You could theoretically travel back in time with your consciousness and observe what happened in the past.
Are they taking like mice? Are they training them to do something and then they systematically erase that ability?
Yeah, exactly. They have trained them to do, you know, a certain thing that they learn. Then they, you know, they learn by memory what that action is, and then they find the place in the brain that, or the multiple places in the brain that hold that information, and they have been able to make that mouse forget that specific learned activity. So it's a little bit scary when you think
about it. It is scary. If they get a hold of us and they want to do that, my gosh.
I know. And if they can erase memories, can they implant memories? And I know that, you know, this kind of research is, it's kind of at its infancy, but every year you read further advances along these lines. And, you know, the brain's an interesting thing. And being able to kind of tap into the data that the brain uses is, you know, is what we're doing now.
Are they, when they do this, are they killing cells? Is that what they're doing?
I'm not really sure, to be honest. I think that, you know, it could be a matter of, you know, flipping a chemical encoding in a neuron or something like that. Might not necessarily kill the cell. It just re-encodes it, if you will.
That is dramatic. It's going way too fast, Jim, isn't it?
It is. It is. Things seem to happen faster and faster every year.
I mean, they're making robots that lie to you now.
I'm not sure what the value of that is. But
I know it. Why would you want that? Okay, we'll be back. There's more. I want to talk with you about that paper you published about SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, where you claim they don't have a chance to detect ET civilizations. Let's find out why when we come back. For just pennies a day, you can be a Coast Insider, formerly Streamlink members, and get podcasting special downloads. Matter of fact, for you insiders, on our Tuesday night chat with Linda Moulton Howe, 8 p.m. Pacific time, you'll be able to ask her some things about stories she's been working on, including mysterious aerial gyroscopes and current stories on her website, earthfiles.com. Linda will be chatting with you tomorrow, 8 p.m. Pacific time, for you Streamlink members, Coast Insiders. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got Jim Elvidge. Jim, the folks from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, they've been on the program numerous times as they talk about their latest technology is they're listening for radio signals out there from some extraterrestrial source. You don't think they have a chance to detect an ET civilization? How come?
I don't really, and certainly not to take anything away from the fine astronomers from SETI, and it definitely is an experiment that captures the imagination. I'm sure you'd agree.
Yes.
But I use Drake's equation, which I think is what those guys use as well. Mm-hmm. This was an equation that astronomer Frank Drake, came up with back in the 60s, I believe. And it has a number of factors in it, and those factors all get multiplied together. And there are things like, what's the likelihood of a star having planets around it? What's the likelihood of, if it does have planets, that one of those planets is habitable, or how many of those might be habitable? What's the likelihood of life forming on those? What's the likelihood of that life evolving to be intelligent? What's the likelihood of that intelligent life wanting to communicate? And you can see how all of those factors have to get kind of multiplied together. I use the latest information with the extrasolar planets that have been found. I don't think I disagree with most of the factors that other people use. For example, I think that it's probably very likely that microbial life will form on any planet in the habitable zone. I mean, if you look at what happened on Earth, the conditions when life formed on Earth 3.8 billion years ago, it was 30 degrees hotter. There was no oxygen. There was much less water. We were under constant cosmic bombardment from asteroids and meteors and things. And there's good evidence that even under those conditions, life formed twice on Earth. Because what was happening at that time was every once in a while there'd be such a massive asteroid would hit the planet that it would generate such tremendous heat that it would effectively be what's referred to as a sterilizing event. Any life that there might have been on the planet up to that point was going to get wiped out.
It was all cooked, right?
Completely cooked.
Yeah.
But what happened was there's evidence of microbial fossils in Greenland 3.85 billion years ago before the last sterilization event occurred. So in other words, that shows that life formed at least two times, and some people think, maybe many more times than that. And that's really important because, one of the arguments for the rare life idea is that it's just such a rare occurrence for it to form at all. But if it can form in such, drastic circumstances twice on our planet, that's good evidence that it's not hard for life to form on other planets that might be in a habitable zone.
Right.
There's also little bugs and things that really can survive amazing, conditions. They call them extremophiles. Things like tardigrades are little 1 millimeter size bugs. They can survive without water for over 100 years. They've been able to survive absolute zero temperatures or very close to it, 300 degrees Fahrenheit, 10 days of vacuum in a space, pressures six times the pressure at the bottom of the ocean, lethal doses of x-rays, stuff that would just kill anything else, these things have no problem with. So, we find life that thrives, microbes that thrive in sulfuric acid and some that eat radioactive elements. And, given all of that, it's not hard for microbial life to form, it seems. But then one of the other factors in Drake's equation is, if microbial life forms, what's the likelihood that it will evolve into intelligent life?
Right.
And, that's a much more debatable one. And I actually use a number that's probably a little more conservative than some other people use. I say it's a 1 in 1,000 chance. But some of the factors beyond that, that's where I kind of depart from the other things that I've seen. So, for example...
But even if it's 1 in 1,000, though, Jim, if you factor in the habitable planets based on estimates, you're still talking about a lot of civilizations.
Oh, absolutely. And don't get me wrong. I think the flip side of this question is, do I think there's life out there, intelligent life? And I think there is, just for that reason, George. But can we communicate with it using radio waves is a different question, because you have to kind of factor in what's the duration of a civilization that's going to use radio wave technology.
I mean, so your concern, though, Jim, is not that it's not out there,
right,
intelligent life, but that the way they're going about it, they're not going to find it that way.
Exactly. And I can't say that they could come up with anything better. This is what we have that we know to communicate with.
It's today. Yeah.
It's perhaps the only option today. But, you know, why did radio even evolve, or not evolve, but why did the technology grow on our planet? It had a lot to do with the fact that we have an ionosphere that bends radio waves. So they propagate very well. Not all planets have that. Or maybe, you know, some other civilization got wired for broadband before they discovered radio, or maybe they communicate via telepathy or something completely unknown to us. That has to get factored in, the likelihood that they would actually use radio. And then you factor in how long of a duration is radio going to be. And actually, radio is it's in a decline, as you know. Shortwave radio is in a serious decline. And our communications now is via low-powered Wi-Fi connections, which from space looks just like broadband noise. It's so small, even... Sure. You know, all the wireless routers in the world added up are just going to generate noise.
And SETI's making the assumption, Jim, that the evolutionary process of radio waves is the same throughout the universe. And I think what you're trying to say is that's not the case.
Exactly. I mean, that's a huge part of it. And then you have to say, let's just, you know, take the argument that we can pump, say, a megawatt of radio power into something the size of the Arecibo dish, that actually only reaches about half the galaxy before it gets absorbed into or down to the level of cosmic background radiation. The other civilization would have to be doing the same thing at exactly the same time, pointed directly at us rather than any of the other billions and billions of stars in the galaxy. And they would have to use the same frequency at the same time we're using that same frequency. So when you factor all these things in here, I got the number which was, you know, 1 × 10⁻². So yeah. it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
So would you disband the project if you were them, or what?
I don't know. I think it has a lot of value in the sense that, like a lot of research projects, that they generate funding that cause new technology to be developed. I'm sure we've gotten better satellite dishes out of this technology. We've gotten better, high-powered low-noise amplifiers and things like that. So, you know, there's value to it. I think it's extremely low probability that we'll contact anybody this way. That said, as you alluded to before, given you know, the likelihood that life can form and the likelihood that it can evolve to an intelligent species and the, you know, amazing number of stars that are out there, you can do that same calculation and take out the factors that have to do with radio communication, and then you end up with something like, it's 4.5 billion civilizations that could be advanced enough to colonize the galaxy. I mean, just, you know, incredible numbers. So, yeah, they do seem to be out there. Why don't we know about them? That's the big question. And the answer to that has to do with whether we're looking at our reality conventionally or whether we're looking at it from a programmed reality standpoint.
And the other thing that, of course, you know, the areas that fascinate mankind, the possibilities of intelligent life out there and then life after death. This quest to find out why we're here and who we are, Jim, do you believe that that is the same throughout? I mean, do you believe in life after death? Is there a soul with these other beings?
I absolutely do, George. I think that there's tremendous evidence for consciousness beyond life. I think we could just point to Dr. Pim von Lummel's book. He's been on your show, I believe. Mm-hmm. He has a book called Consciousness Beyond Life. He spent 20 years of research proving via scientific methods that the near-death experience isn't due to imagination. It's not due to oxygen deprivation or psychoses or anything related to brain function. You know, instead, there's something else out there. And, you know, his evidence, you know, there are other, you know, kinds of evidence we could point to, like identical twins. They have nearly identical genetics and identical environmental upbringing, and yet many times they are completely different personalities. What accounts for that? You know, there's something else other than brain function, genetics, and environment that accounts for why people make the decisions they do or have the values they do. And I think that that is the soul.
Well, that could very well be. And if that's the case, why is it there, in your opinion?
Why is the soul there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It sure is.
But I think that, you know, the idea of a programmed reality is very consistent with that. It's like thinking of your body as an avatar and the soul being elsewhere. I mean, it doesn't have to be in a pod being nurtured by something like the movie The Matrix. It could be, you know, playing a simulation, or it could be, you know, in some form of energy that we just don't understand at this point. But it's definitely consistent with all the evidence for consciousness beyond life.
You know, will science, do you think, ever stumble into this and get some of these answers for us as we get more and more technologically advanced? Will they answer these, what seem to be metaphysical questions?
Yeah, I do think they will, George. In fact, I'm impressed with things like the book that we just mentioned, Dr. Pinbaum Lummel's book. He's, you know, he's a researcher. He had the courage to spend 20 years researching this using scientific methods. And science isn't just, you know, like a experimental apparatus and results. Science also has to do with polls and asking questions and, getting data in that manner. You know, one piece of data is just an anecdote, but a million pieces of data that all line up or that add up to something beyond a statistical significance, then that's scientific as well. And that's the kind of stuff that needs to be done to get to these metaphysical questions, because they're not the kind of things that are reproducible easily, are they?
How much does the brain have to do with this, Jim? I mean, what does the brain concoct that could cross those lines?
The way I look at it, George, and I certainly don't have the answer. This is just my guess at how it all works, is that the brain is kind of like a cache. If you're familiar with your computer, has caches, which are they're very fast memory devices that store the things that you most frequently use. So it makes the computer seem to run faster rather than have to go to the disk all the time for data. It stores it in memory. And Google, for example, they cache their entire index. That's why Google was so fast, and that's why they became the number one search engine, is because they put their index in hardware that was very, very fast to access.
Very smart to do, wasn't it?
It was very smart to do. And I think the brain may be the same way. Like, I think there's probably something out there. You know, some people call it the Akashic record. We don't know what the mechanism is that stores data, but the mere fact that people can tap into data that's beyond what's in their brain, and this has been proven over and over. I mean, there are people who can be hypnotized to regress to a point where they can speak some old language, like Old Norse or something like that. And, you know, it's unexplainable because they never learned it. It's not in their brain function, but they have gone out of the cache and they've gone out to some other mechanism, to this other repository of data to get this. And that's, you know, that's another proof of the fact that there's something beyond consciousness, or beyond the brain in terms of consciousness.
Could you call it our divine intelligence, the creator?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's definitely along the right lines. I mean, whether it's one creator or multiple creators, you know, if we're in a programmed reality, which again, the evidence is just kind of overwhelming for, somebody wrote the program and it wasn't us, because we're not capable of doing that yet. We do have petaflop computers that have a quadrillion floating point operations per second, like amazing speeds, but we can't emulate a reality, a universe, the way we seem to be perceiving it. So if this theory is right, then there clearly has to be a much more advanced intelligence behind it. And what that is, you know, I think I've actually kind of narrowed down that a little bit just from some of the metaphysical research that goes on, and that's kind of a different area too.
When you think of the possibilities that this intelligence has intertwined all these pieces of this puzzle, they all fit perfectly, Jim. It's an incredible design, isn't it?
It is an incredible design. And when you kind of think about it and think about how it might work, you know, like if, you know, one way to design this could be that everything that happens based on the state of, say, all the particles in the universe, you know, what they are, where they are, and the direction that they're going. And from that, and from, you know, a concrete set of laws of physics, you could calculate what's going to happen at any point in time. But we know from the observer effect, from the things that you and I talked about earlier, that there's another factor here. There's another input to this this process or this programmatic function, and that input is our consciousness, our intent to do things, and that input, it's not 100%, it's not very clear cut. It seems to be following some sort of fuzzy logic, if you will, or some probability distribution, like, you know, maybe 53% of the time that somebody intends to do something, you know, it happens, as opposed to 100% of the time. But that 53% is significant because, and I actually picked that number for a reason. There was a recent study by an individual from Cornell University, my alma mater, who determined after 8 years of study that precognition was a real effect, that people could really predict a little bit into the future. And the number that he came up with, the percentage that this happened, was about 53%. And one might look at that and say, oh, well, that's, you know, that's not that much. It's not much more than 50%. But it can be if you perform the experiment enough times. It's kind of like flipping a penny. If I flip a penny 100 times, the odds that it'd be 53 or more is, I don't know, maybe 20, 30%. But if I flip it 1,000,000 times, the odds that it would be 530,000 or more is almost insignificant.
I want to talk about multi dimensions and the multiverse, Jim, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.